It's the morning of April 28, 1789. A British ship sails through the Pacific Ocean near the island of Tofua. Below deck, 34-year-old Lieutenant William Bligh sleeps soundly in his quarters. Bligh is the commander of this vessel, the HMS Bounty, a Royal Navy ship on a supply run from Tahiti to the West Indies. Right now, he's getting some much-needed rest, but his sleep is interrupted when the door to his cabin flies open. Bligh wakes with a start as several armed men rush into his cabin and pull him from his bunk. For a split second, Bligh wonders if his ship has been boarded by enemy sailors. But then, when he sees the faces of his assailants, he realizes this is no ordinary attack. It's mutiny. Bligh struggles to resist as his crew hauls him outside onto the Bounty's upper deck. There, he sees some sailors loyal to him being shoved toward the side of the ship at gunpoint. Then Bligh is approached by one of his officers, an experienced seaman named Fletcher Christian. Bligh holds his head high as Fletcher tells him that he has been relieved of command. Bligh looks Fletcher square in the eye and assures him that he would be punished for this mutiny. Fletcher pushes Bligh onto a ladder down the side of the Bounty's hull. Bligh's face is red with rage as he descends to a small boat bobbing in the ocean. He watches in fuming silence as half the crew are forced to join him. Then, from up above on deck, Fletcher severs a rope and the boat drifts away. Bligh's tiny crew begins to row, and every man prepares himself for the long and perilous voyage back to civilization. Bligh knows that even if he's lucky enough to survive, his reputation will be severely damaged by this event. Still, he is determined to make it back to land and report this mutiny, doing whatever it takes to redeem his good name. The Bounty mutineers, as Fletcher Christian and his compatriots are known, gave William Bligh and his men some basic supplies like food, fresh water, and swords to defend themselves against the natives of the Pacific Islands. But after casting them adrift in the Pacific, the mutineers do not expect them to survive long. William Bligh, though, is a determined man. In the course of just over 6 weeks, Bligh's small boat sails more than 4,000 miles before it arrives at a Dutch colony in modern-day Indonesia. After surviving the mutiny on the Bounty and the long voyage at sea, Bligh also survives a naval inquiry that exonerates him of any blame in the incident. This result helps Bligh repair the damage to his reputation and rebuild his career in the Royal Navy. But the mutiny on the Bounty is not the last time William Bligh's subordinates will turn against him. 19 years later, Bligh will face a second uprising. Only this time, his career will come to an unceremonious end after he is deposed as governor of New South Wales, Australia, on January 26, 1808. From Noiser, an airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is January 26, 1808, the Rum Rebellion. It's September 1801, 7 years before William Bligh is deposed for a second time. Just outside Sydney, in the British colony of New South Wales, Australia, a duel is nearly underway. 34-year-old Captain John MacArthur loads his pistol under the careful supervision of his second, Captain John Piper. Traditionally, the second is responsible for loading the weapon, but MacArthur is about to put his life on the line. The next few moments might be his last, so he's not taking any chances. When MacArthur is finished loading the weapon himself, he glances up at the man who challenged him to this duel, a fellow naval officer and his direct superior, Colonel William Patterson. MacArthur and Patterson's disagreement is about honor, but it is also about alcohol. Since Sydney was established as Britain's first colonial settlement in Australia, soldiers like Captain MacArthur have been responsible for keeping order. But the officers in the New South Wales Corps, men like MacArthur and Patterson, quickly realized that they could subsidize their wages. Many got into the illegal liquor trade and began importing rum into the colonies without paying taxes or duties to the British Crown. This earned these officers a nickname, the Rum Corps. But soon, tensions arose in the Rum Corps as various officers competed for business using increasingly dubious methods. Today, Captain MacArthur is answering the challenge of Colonel William Patterson, who is accusing MacArthur of blackmail. Now MacArthur holds up his pistol to signal he is ready to defend his honor. He strides to one side, glaring at Patterson, while their seconds toss a coin to decide who will fire first. MacArthur smiles when he is told he will have the first shot. The two men take their places, and MacArthur lifts his pistol and takes aim. He slows down his breathing and points the barrel at Patterson's chest. Then he softly pulls the trigger. MacArthur's hand jerks back as the pistol fires and smoke erupts from the barrel. Patterson collapses backward with a cry, his second rushing toward him. But miraculously, Patterson painfully gets back to his feet. MacArthur has a moment of panic, thinking that Patterson is preparing to return fire. But Patterson grunts in pain as he tries to lift his arm. Blood blossoms on his shoulder. The pistol drops out of his fingers. Patterson shakes his head, muttering that he can't fire, and then slumps to the ground. A week later, MacArthur sits in the parlor of his expensive home on the outskirts of Sydney. There's a light knock on the door, and he looks up to see the familiar and unwelcome face of a soldier standing guard, ensuring he is kept under house arrest. But walking past that soldier and into the house is Captain Piper, MacArthur's second. Piper says that he has an update on MacArthur's situation and reports that although Colonel Patterson lost a lot of blood, he will survive. But there's more news. The governor of the colony is insisting that MacArthur face a court-martial. MacArthur nods, unsurprised. After all, a duel between two officers cannot go unpunished. He asks whether the panel of jurors has been chosen. MacArthur hopes they will be made up of officers from the Rum Corps because he knows they won't want to convict one of their own. But Piper says the trial will not be held in Australia and explains that the governor thinks the trial will not be fair if MacArthur is judged by his peers. So instead, MacArthur is being shipped back to London. MacArthur's face drops. But Piper tries to reassure him. A trial in London will not likely go in his favor, that's true. But MacArthur's friends in the Rum Corps will make sure the evidence against him never reaches London. And soon, MacArthur and a pile of evidence sent by the governor are loaded onto a ship bound for home. But when the boat docks in London, the governor's evidence has mysteriously disappeared. The army has no choice but to quietly drop the case against MacArthur. Acquitted, MacArthur resigns his commission and quits the army. But he is not yet finished with New South Wales. The ex-army man secures a grant from the colonial office in London for 10,000 acres of land near the colony to graze sheep. And then he heads back to Sydney to start a new career. But in August 1806, MacArthur's ambitions and growing wealth will bring him into the sights of the brand new governor of New South Wales, the infamous captain of the Bounty, William Bligh. It's December 1807, 1 month before the Rum Rebellion. Captain Glenn, skipper of the merchant vessel Parramatta, is happy to see Sydney Harbor again after a five-month voyage to transport a cargo of wood to Tahiti. It's been a trouble-free voyage, apart from discovering an escaped convict who stowed away when the Parramatta left Sydney. Captain Glenn dealt with him by letting the convict go free in Tahiti, rather than face questions about how he got on board from the authorities or his boss, John MacArthur. Captain Glenn stands on the deck of his ship as his crew maneuvers his vessel against the wharf of Sydney Harbor. Looking out, he marvels at the progress that's been made in the colony. New buildings and warehouses line the docks. But Captain Glenn's moment of peace is interrupted when he catches a small company of soldiers marching toward his ship. Instantly, he suspects he knows why they're coming. They must have found out about the stowaway. As soon as Captain Glenn's crew lowers the gangplank, the soldiers bound up the ramp. The officer in charge approaches Captain Glenn and asks whether the ship is the Parramatta, owned by John MacArthur. Captain Glenn confirms it is. Then the officer declares that the ship and her crew are being seized on orders of the governor, William Bligh. 2 years ago, William Bligh arrived in Sydney to take up an appointment as the new governor of New South Wales. He was tasked by the Colonial Office in London with reining in the power of the Rum Corps. So after his arrival, Bligh promptly banned soldiers from importing and trading rum, allowing only merchants licensed by him to participate in the lucrative trade. But Bligh also butted heads with the wealthy and influential figures of the colony, and nobody was more wealthy and powerful than John MacArthur. Bligh confiscated MacArthur's illegal alcohol stills. He threw into question MacArthur's land grants, and now Bligh is harassing his merchant boat. Captain Glenn tries to stop his hands from shaking as the officer reads a proclamation declaring that the Parramatta is barred from sailing because the ship has been used to harbor convicts. Captain Glenn sputters that the convict was not allowed on board. He was a stowaway and only discovered when the ship was underway. The officer asks where the convict is now, and Captain Glenn pauses. Eventually, he says that the convict ran away when they docked at Tahiti. The officer shakes his head. He says that this affair will have to be dealt with by the courts. A few weeks later, on January 25, 1808, Judge Advocate Richard Atkins calls his court to order. Not only is Judge Atkins the presiding officer of this court, he is also the senior legal mind in New South Wales. Today, he's due to hear the case against John MacArthur, a wealthy and wily man that will likely use every technique in the book to wriggle out of the charges against him. After the Parramatta was impounded by Governor Bligh, MacArthur and his business partner were issued a large fine for allowing a convict to escape on board their ship. But MacArthur saw the fine as part of Bligh's vindictive campaign against him. He refused to pay and wrote a withering letter outlining his scorn and contempt for the governor. Bligh responded by arresting MacArthur for sedition. Now Judge Atkins will stand judgment. Atkins glances at the six officers of the Rum Corps who have been sworn in as the jury. Atkins suspects that they will be sympathetic to their old colleague, John MacArthur, but that's none of his concern. His job is to preside over a fair proceeding. So Atkins begins by reading out the charges against MacArthur and asking how he pleads. MacArthur answers that he will not enter a plea until Atkins recuses himself from the trial. Atkins is stunned and asked why he should. MacArthur explains that Atkins is not a neutral arbiter of the case because Atkins owes MacArthur money. The judge's mouth falls agape. He almost forgot about the small amount of money he borrowed from MacArthur. He stutters that a small debt is no reason to withdraw from the case. And then Atkins turns and addresses the Rum Corps officers and the jury, explaining that, according to British law, if MacArthur refuses to enter a plea, they must assume he is declaring himself not guilty. But one of the officers stands and interrupts Atkins. The officer says that he agrees with MacArthur and thinks Atkins should step down from the case. Atkins almost starts shaking at the impertinence. He then declares the court to be in recess and announces that it will reconvene tomorrow after he has consulted with the governor. But the Rum Corps officers ignore him. They confiscate official court documents and refuse to serve as a jury until Atkins recuses himself. This false start to MacArthur's trial leads to open rebellion. Governor Bligh insists that the court reconvene, but the Rum Corps officers refuse to hand over the paperwork they stole. In response, Bligh will order his men to arrest the officers for treason. But this will only escalate the bitter conflict and spark the New South Wales Corps into mutiny. It's 6 p.m. on January 26, 1808. One day after John MacArthur's trial was suspended. Captain Thomas Laycock marches along the road to Government House, the residence of the governor in New South Wales. 400 soldiers trail behind him, followed by a band and a color guard carrying the flag of the Rum Corps. Captain Laycock is in a cheerful mood because Governor William Bligh, a man who has been a thorn in the side of the Rum Corps ever since his arrival, is finally being shown who truly controls New South Wales. Earlier this morning, Governor Bligh issued warrants for the arrest of the Rum Corps officers who refused to serve on MacArthur's jury. But Captain Laycock's commanding officer, Major George Johnston, was incensed at Bligh's threats. Johnston marched on the town jail with a company of soldiers and ordered MacArthur to be released. Then Johnston and MacArthur plotted the overthrow of Governor Bligh. Now Laycock is here to follow his commander's orders and take Bligh into custody. When he arrives at Government House, Laycock raps officiously on the door. After a moment's pause, Bly's daughter answers. Before Laycock can say a word, she angrily declares that Bly is not home and blocks the way in. Laycock gently pushes her aside and enters Government House, his soldiers crowding behind him. Laycock then orders his men to search the home. They run up the stairs, keen to be the man to arrest the hated governor. And after a moment, Laycock hears a shout from the top floor. He bounds up the stairs and into a bedroom. There, soldiers stand with their weapons pointed at a bed. Laycock walks further into the room for a better look and finds Bly crouched behind the bed, cowering. Laycock orders the soldiers to take him into custody. Bly spends the next year under house arrest. When a new governor is sent from Britain, Bly is sent back to England to face another inquiry. The Rum Rebellion is declared an illegal mutiny, but the British government brushes the affair under the carpet. MacArthur keeps his freedom under a promise to stay out of government affairs. And just like with the mutiny on the Bounty, William Bly is absolved of all blame. But this time, the damage to his reputation will be too great to overcome. Bly will never again receive an important command. Britain's leaders are simply too suspicious of the man who was on the receiving end of a second mutiny when the Rum Rebellion occurred on January 26, 1808. Next on History Daily, January 27, 1959, Disney's Sleeping Beauty bombs at the box office, leading the studio not to make another animated princess movie for 30 years. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily. Hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing and sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Scott Reeves. Produced by Alexandra Curry Buckner. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.